This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Well, a few things have happened since we last talked to you, dear listener. Now, unfortunately, my voice hasn't gotten any better, but looking back at the last few days, I sort of recall the moment when Pee Wee Herman made his first public appearance on stage down in L.A. after his, his scandalous arrest. Pee Wee came out, looked at the audience and said, "Hey, heard any good jokes lately?" Yeah, apparently Joe Biden decided to put country ahead of personal interest and withdraw from the presidential race. This is not unprecedented, but it doesn't happen very often. Yours truly is old enough to remember the last time that it did happen, which was in March of 1968. Lyndon Johnson, the incumbent president, was facing a lot of pushback on how badly the Vietnam War was going. It was becoming most unpopular. But wouldn't you know it, party politics, being the corrupt business that it is, forces opposing the war could not get a senator to come forth and challenge Johnson until I believe Frank Mankiewicz and a few others went around the Senate office building and found that Eugene McCarthy said, "Yeah, I'll do it." Gene McCarthy was not a powerhouse in the U.S. Senate. He was not a big player, but he was a senator. He did have national standing, and he challenged Johnson. In the New Hampshire primary, he got close enough, something like 1 percentage point difference. He didn't win, but he got within a percentage point to where Johnson realized, "I'm cooked. I'm not going to be able to do this." So Johnson, being Johnson, decided what he was going to do was be a wire puller and make his vice president, Hubert Horatio Humphrey, the nominee. Johnson didn't even think he had to enter Humphrey in all the various Democratic primaries. And indeed, it turned out he didn't have to because Humphrey got the nomination. He was assisted in the process, of course, by the assassination of Robert Kennedy, who joined McCarthy in challenging Johnson for the future of the Democratic Party. And hold on, we'll have more to say about politicians and whizzing bullets in a moment. But I must confess at this juncture that this program is very dependent upon Edward McMillan for his not just outstanding editing, but support of the fact that we need to keep talking about this stuff. Yours truly has been feeling, well, kind of like...
Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!
Now, in case you're not old enough to remember that memorable bit of sports reporting, that was Howard Cosell calling the fight between Smokin' Joe Frazier and George Foreman. Smokin' Joe was a pretty tough cookie, and yet when he went up against George Foreman, Foreman just knocked him down again, then knocked him down again. Now, I believe that Joe was saved by the bell after the first three knockdowns, but in the very next round, if my memory serves me correctly, he went to canvas three more times, and after the sixth one, they decided to stop it. After all that's been happening lately on the national political scene, I sort of feel like Joe Frazier, maybe after about the third knockdown. But Mr. Miller feels the show must go on, and so it is going on. Yay! Our resident expert on things Trump says he's happy to join us on next week's program, and we look forward to that. Trump expert, of course, being Stephen J. Harper, adjunct professor of law at Northwestern University, and I'd have to say an expert on things Trump. What I think we're going to do for part of today's program, at least, is to not try and break trail, but rather echo some of the good work that's being done by others out there. We've been impressed by the work of Dave Pakman, as well as Ben Mycelis, in stringing together a bunch of clips of Trump and others blabbing about this or that, and then giving you their analysis of it, which it so happens coincides quite nicely with our analysis of it. I think what we'll probably do is devote most of our second segment today to doing that. One of the issues they dwell on is Trump's mental fitness to serve as president. Cartoonist Nick Anderson summarized the post-debate analysis pretty well in a two-panel cartoon, the first showing a bunch of Democrats screaming about how Biden, my goodness, he just didn't perform as well as he should. What are we going to do? With the panel adjoining it titled Republicans Hashing Out Legitimate Concerns About Their Candidate's Fitness for Office, which is blank. Now, we mentioned in this program, I believe I mentioned in this program, that I intended to look back at the debate between Biden and Trump and see what I might learn from forcing myself to stick through the 90 minutes or approximately 90 minutes of blah, blah, blah. Now, when the debate took place, yours truly decided to multitask in the backyard, so I listened to the bulk of it on the radio and therefore didn't fully appreciate the blank stare of Joe Biden and how lost he appeared at many junctures and basically what the fuss was all about. You know, it's true. He didn't look stellar, although it wasn't all bad. But in going back and watching the entirety of the debate, back and forth, Trump, Biden, I was just flabbergasted at what they let Trump get away with. Someone did a tally and came up with like 28 out-and-out lies that he told. I'm surprised the number is that small. I didn't tally them up myself. But regardless of the number, the sheer volume, the size of the lies was a factor. At one point, Trump told the American public that under Roe v. Wade, they could take the baby out in the 9th month, and maybe even after it was born, which in a sane world would have caused the moderators to stop the debate right there and just say, that's absolutely not true, Mr. Former President. But CNN decided to not do that. They decided to let them go. And, you know, you're at a huge disadvantage. We've said on this program many times that, you know, you can tell when a politician's lying because his lips are moving. There's truth in that. So we don't expect the unvarnished truth to come from the mouth of Joe Biden or any other politician. But the degree to which Donald Trump just laid these whoppers out there was pretty amazing. Trump told the public that what everybody wanted regarding abortion was for it to go back to the states, which is very definitely not what everybody wanted. Trump told the American public that the most dangerous area on the world was the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, it so happens that my girlfriend and I traveled down to Mexico in April for the eclipse and thereby crossed the Mexican border. And I'm here to tell you, it ain't all that dangerous. Trump's stunning rudeness just came through again and again. Just looking at the camera and saying, veterans can't stand this guy. But they like me more than just about anybody. He tried to blame the fiasco in Afghanistan on Biden when it was Trump coming to a very hard ending to that ridiculously long, prolonged conflict that was the root of the problem. One of my favorite moments was when they tried to pin Trump down on whether he would favor an independent Palestinian state. He replied, "I'd have to see," and then changed the subject. He's made it clear that NATO and our NATO allies are going to be subject to whatever the hell might happen to them if they don't pay their bills. He argued that the January 6th attack on the nation's capital was not his fault. Nope, it was Nancy Pelosi's. He said more than once that Nancy Pelosi confessed that it's my responsibility. And we all know, of course, that Nancy Pelosi spent weeks before January 6th sending out messages to all of Trump's followers to advise them to come to the Capitol. It'll be wild. Oh, no, that was Trump that said that. Trump managed to steer around the issue of abortion and how it is that, thanks to him, Roe v. Wade's been overturned. Trump kept saying in the most rather racist fashion that, you know, all these 18 million people coming up from the border, which is a made-up number, 18 million people, they're being put up in luxury hotels while our veterans are out in the streets. He made the claim that these countries were emptying out their mental institutions, jails, and prisons and sending them north. Anyway, I need to stop. I don't know what debates really solve. I mean, they're kind of a beauty contest in many respects. People go into a debate and they root for somebody and they think the person they're rooting for did well. That's been my experience in debates. Although I must say, in a brief conversation with Stephen Harper, Harper is expressing the great hope that Trump will honor his commitment to do a debate in the fall, this time with Kamala Harris, former prosecutor, former attorney general of the state of California. A part of me hopes we get to see that, but, you know, seeing how well they handled the last debate and how Trump was given a pass, basically, I'm not that optimistic that the strategy of let Trump be Trump and have that turn the public off is going to work. I don't think it'll hurt when they talk about abortion rights that Kamala Harris is a woman. These are remarkable times we're living in. Joe Biden dropping out of the race First time a president's done that since 1968. A week after, Donald Trump almost takes a bullet to the head. And I saw a recreation on the internet, which I can't vouch for how accurate it was. It looked pretty good, showing how close Donald Trump was to receiving a fatal injury. And it was close indeed. I've seen some claim that the whole thing was put up. It was all fake. We do not endorse that theory. To do so, you have to explain the dead guy up on the roof. Now, one thing that I think cannot go unmentioned is the fact that a lot of people are talking about how important it is that we preserve our democracy. And believe you me, we're all for that. I have to say, though, I've always thought there was something peculiarly undemocratic about the process by which a ticket of a party is chosen. Someone takes the top role, the president, and someone takes the bottom role, the vice president. They had to make a special amendment to the Constitution to clarify this matter, because in the 1800 election, it turned out that Thomas Jefferson on the top of the ticket and Aaron Burr on the bottom of the ticket were both tied at 73 because no one thought to specify whether the vote was for president or vice president. Burr tried to cut a deal that would make him the president, being that he was rather shady wheeler dealer from New York. And you know what those guys are like. Anyway, Jefferson's longtime rival, I guess you'd say, Alexander Hamilton, threw his support behind Jefferson to become president, something Burr did not forget, and I'm sure was instrumental in the fact that he later killed Hamilton in a duel. Anyway, they got together and said, no, we got to have another amendment to explain that, no, we're going to do it, you know, someone is the top, someone's the bottom, we're going to clarify it. We'll have electors go for one or the other. And, oh, by the way, we can't have both candidates come from the same state. Which is why those of you who would like to see Gavin Newsom go on the ticket as the vice president must be denied. Of course, let's backtrack a bit. How can it be that Kamala Harris, who was chosen by Joe Biden and I presume a few other cigar-chomping wheeler-dealers in the Democratic Party to be the vice presidential pick back in 2000, is now anointed by Joe Biden and we assume a few other backroom deal makers to become the heir apparent. Say what you want about this. It's not a very democratic process, shall we say. Now, it's true, according to the rules of the parties, that Biden has released his delegates and they can vote for Harris or not. And I think right now there's so much panic going on in the Democratic Party that they want to rally around someone. What they don't want is a floor fight in Chicago next month, where someone else challenges Harris, and, well, it'd be a repeat of 1968's Chicago convention that did not look good on television. Many people think that the riots, which are, to a large degree, police riots that took place in Chicago at the convention, really helped ease Richard Nixon into the White House. Well, it also didn't hurt that Richard Nixon committed treason by having agents go over and have the South Vietnamese government pull out of the peace talks, telling him, you'll get a better deal from us. He was deathly afraid that Lyndon Johnson would pull a rabbit out of a hat before the election and that Hubert Humphrey would be the beneficiary and thus become president. Humphrey almost made it anyway, as it turned out. But since we are hearkening back to 1968 and Johnson's withdrawal from the race, realizing he wasn't going to be able to win, we should point out that Johnson, we're pretty sure, thought he was going to continue as the de facto president by virtue of the fact that he would have a great deal of control over his former vice president. Johnson famously once said, I don't trust any man till I got his pecker in my pocket. And I got Hubert's pecker in my pocket. For the record, Mr. McMillan is against anybody having his pecker in his pocket. And we presume vice versa. Now, if you've been listening to this program for decades, and God knows we hope you have been, you may know that we interviewed Senator Eugene McCarthy back in the aughts. We stumbled into that possible interview thanks to someone that knew McCarthy. That would be writer Roger S. Peterson, who himself has also been on this program, and a good guest he was as well. We knew that we'd be in Washington, D.C. At some point, and asked the senator if we might drop in and visit him at his nursing facility, which we did. Now, if you don't recall the 1968 campaign, and God knows I'm guessing that most of you don't, after Johnson withdrew from the race, McCarthy jumped in, showed that he could do pretty well. He actually got within one percentage point of Johnson, showed that Johnson was vulnerable, leading Robert F. Kennedy Sr. to jump into the race. Unfortunately, the two men then divided the anti-war sentiment and then fought each other while Humphrey stayed out, completely stayed out of the primaries. The night that RFK won the California primary, he had a huge leg up in winning at the convention. But we'll never know what happened because he was murdered within hours of the final vote count. Some have wondered if RFK had not jumped into the race and Eugene McCarthy had been the standard bearer for the anti-war movement, would he have been able to take on LBJ and Hubert Humphrey and secure the nomination? I'm pleased to say I was able to ask him that question in his nursing home. His answer? No way. I think Senator McCarthy knew what he was up against when it came to the wire pulling of Lyndon Baines Johnson. But it is interesting that here we are in 2024 with someone going into the convention who was not in any of the primaries, at least at the top of the ticket, who's likely to get the nomination, just as Hubert H. Humphrey did back in 1968. Now, I think we can know darn well, looking back at it, that if Johnson wanted Humphrey to be the Democratic nominee, it was going to be Humphrey. I don't think that Joe Biden is going to turn out to be that kind of wire puller. But my God, in the weeks to come, we shall see, won't we? Back to Gavin Newsom, who is not likely to be at the top of the ticket, although you never know. As you may know, we're not huge fans of Governor Newsom. We saw what he did to the city of San Francisco when he was the mayor, which was a direct lead up to the catastrophe we now see with homeless encampments everywhere, businesses that have been there for generations shuttering. And we were especially unhappy with then Mayor Newsom back in 2004, when during a very tight race between John Kerry and George W. Bush. Newsom, it would be an excellent time to hold a press conference on the steps of City Hall and announce that gay men and women could now get marriage licenses. Now, regardless of where you stand on the issue, there's such a thing as timing. And as it turned out, this was a boon to the Republicans. They like to point out where you're going to get with San Francisco values. And the truth is, the goal of gay marriage was achieved within a few years. Newsom didn't have to pull that political stunt when he did, but he did. 1 week after taking office, he had a press conference and announced that he was not in favor of the twin tunnel solution of Jerry Brown to send yet more water from the Delta south so that real estate development can continue whole hog out in the desert and that monsoon crops can continue to be grown in the desert. Newsom said he was not in favor of the twin tunnels. He was in favor of a single tunnel, which they've slowly been working on, kind of trying to stay under the radar, trying to pretend that this is going to improve the ecology of the Delta. We've asked in this program many times how it is you think you can improve the ecology of a wetland by removing its water. In Gavin's latest stunt, and I hate to come down on Gavin Newsom, but considering what the opposition is up to, but I feel I must. Here's the deal. Gavin Newsom signed a law passed by the legislature after some school districts enacted policies requiring employees to inform parents if their child changed their gender expression. For example, by changing their name or pronoun. Billionaire Elon Musk, who's estranged from his transgender child, responded by announcing he planned to move the SpaceX headquarters from California to Texas, saying this is the final straw. Now, maybe Elon Musk is looking for an excuse, because if you know people in Silicon Valley, and I know quite a few, you know that most of them are not arch conservatives. Well, at least the rank and file. The tech titans all seem to be lining up behind Trump. For example, Elon Musk has promised $45 million a month to Trump. Was this over the transgender thing? Well, surely not, but you know, it didn't help. And believe me, I don't want to get too far in the weeds on the trans issue today, but I do note that Pamela Paul, writing in the New York Times, had some things to say. such as why are Biden administration agencies and medical associations still ignoring the science on, quote, gender-affirming care, unquote, for minors? 3 months ago, a comprehensive assessment commissioned by the UK's National Health Service concluded that the use of puberty blockers, hormones, and surgery did not ease the psychological distress of most teens with gender identity issues, and these issues usually resolve over time without medical treatment. The report by pediatrician Hilary Cass led the British government to issue an emergency ban on puberty blockers, and medical societies throughout Europe are moving away from the medical approach. But here in the U.S., the American Medical Association and other medical groups have ignored or dismissed the Cass review. And the Biden administration still endorses gender-affirming care for adolescents. That's because they've been intimidated by transgender activists' insistence that all contrary evidence is transphobic. So minors continue to receive interventions that leave them with lifelong infertility, sexual dysfunction, and other medical problems. In other words, the U.S. continues to put ideology ahead of science. And boy, when it comes to putting ideology ahead of science, I hate to beat up too much on the Democrats on this, given that Donald Trump's ham-fisted mismanagement of the COVID crisis killed several hundred thousand Americans who didn't need to die. They followed his advice that they didn't need to isolate, they didn't need to wear masks, they didn't need to get vaccines, they didn't need to do this, that, or the other, and they paid for it with their lives. You have to admire Trump for his ability to hang on to a large batch of followers when he's been killing them by the thousands. Now, in the wake of the attempted assassination on Donald Trump, Joe Biden gave a speech trying to pull the nation together, announcing that this sort of violence is not who we are. And I must take issue with the president on this. If you take a look at presidents and presidential candidates who have been shot or attempts were made to shoot them, it's quite a lengthy list. Jefferson Morley of JFKFacts.com published an item a couple days ago about the first such attempt at shooting a president, which was Andrew Jackson, circa 1835. Apparently, a deranged house painter accosted Jackson, leaving a funeral, pulled out a pistol, and it misfired. Then he pulled out a second pistol, and it misfired. An outraged Jackson then charged the man and apparently beat the hell out of him. The district attorney of Washington, Francis Scott Key, yes, he of the national anthem, evaluated the would-be assassin, decided he was nuttier than a fruitcake, and had him put in an asylum where he remained for the next 40 years. Jackson always claimed that the would-be assassin was part of a bigger plot, but no compelling evidence ever emerged for that. Now, in the case of Abraham Lincoln, there was plenty of good evidence that Lincoln fell victim to a plot. Four co-conspirators of John Wilkes Booth were hanged. One of them was supposed to kill Vice President Andrew Johnson, but apparently got drunk instead. One of the assailants did attack with a knife, I believe the Secretary of State, who sustained some grievous wounds but survived. So that one was clearly a conspiracy. In 1881, James Garfield was shot by a disgruntled office seeker. He thought he was promised a job in the new administration, and when he didn't get it, he was angry. So he shot the president. Now, as a medical doctor, I've read the account of how Garfield was managed in the wake of his shooting, and I will have to say that I agree with the assassin, Charles Guiteau, that I shot Garfield, but his doctors killed him. By the way, Garfield's death elevated Chester Alan Arthur to the White House. Chet Arthur had never run for office and had distinguished himself in Republican Party circles by standing up for the New York Port Authority when President Rutherford B. Hayes tried to clean it up. One of the political fixers of the era, hearing that Garfield had expired, said, "Chet Arthur's president? Oh my God!" But Arthur, realizing that the assassin was part of a faction which included Arthur, decided he needed to clean up the government. He instituted the civil service, something which Donald Trump is intent upon revising after all these years. Back in the 1800s, if you served as a political operative, you then got a job in the administration. Well, that was reformed to a substantial degree and is not to the liking of Donald J. Trump. All right, 20 years later, an anarchist accosts President William McKinley and puts a bullet into him. I think he put two bullets into him. Leon Czolgosz was never found to be part of a larger conspiracy, and he got the death penalty for his troubles because McKinley didn't make it. But Teddy Roosevelt then became the president and was one of our better presidents. So is every cloud of a silver lining? I don't know. In 1932, I believe, was president-elect Franklin Roosevelt got shot at while driving the streets of Chicago. The assailant killed the mayor. Roosevelt survived. His successor, Harry Truman, was assaulted by, I believe, four Puerto Rican nationalists when he was sleeping in the Blair House during White House renovations. One of the would-be assassins was killed in the process. A Secret Service agent died in the process. And Truman survived, and the rounded up men went to jail. And then there's John F. Kennedy in 1963. Some say it was the act of one man. We're here to tell you it wasn't. And that's all I'm going to say. Before the decade was out, JFK's brother, Robert, was killed in 1968. And would-be Democratic nominee George Wallace was shot down, not killed, but rendered a paraplegic, in 1972. Gerald Ford got shot at twice in 1975. And in 1981, Ronald Reagan took a bullet in his pericardium and, thanks to excellent medical care, survived. Now, 1981 was four decades ago, so I guess it's easy for someone to say, you know, presidential aspirants getting shot is not who we are. And no, it's not who all of us are, but there seems to be a minority of us that it does apply to. We should keep in mind as we close this segment that the man who almost took an AR-15 bullet to the head has, during his rallies, advocated violence against people protesting him and has been very clear that he intends retribution against his political enemies if and when he returns to the White House. And we'll have more to say about that in our second segment. This is Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. Stick around. Happiness is a warm gun. Happiness is a warm gun, mama. When I hold you in my arms and I feel my finger on your trigger, I know nobody can do me